Wondery Plus subscribers can listen to Tides of History early and ad-free right now. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or Apple Podcasts. Thin rays of sunlight found their way through the smattering of iron-gray clouds. The sun wasn't often visible as the shortest day of the year approached and the rain relentlessly pounded downward. Even when the orange orb might peek through the clouds, there was little illumination to be had. The sun barely seemed to rise above the horizon as it woke, just lifting its head before returning to slumber once again. The darkness didn't stop the activity, though. Hundreds of voices laughing, singing, shouting, and simply talking came together in a low roar, drowning out the squealing pigs, shattering pottery, and a multitude of other sounds that marked the largest gathering of the year. The people had come to this place from all over Britain, trekking along frozen ridges and taking small boats along the icy rivers, suffering the pelting rain amid the perpetual semi-darkness that came just before the winter solstice. But this was a time of celebration, of feasting, when relatives and friends renewed relationships that might otherwise slip away with dozens or hundreds of miles of distance in between. This collection of small rectangular houses was only fully occupied on these rare occasions, when the smell of roasting pig hung in the air outside the half-circle meeting hall and the massive circle of timber posts stuck in the ground. This was the land of the living. But soon, as sunset on the shortest day of the year approached, the assembled people would make the solemn journey to the land of the dead. Clutching leather bags filled with the ashes and burnt bones of their cremated loved ones, they would leave behind the timber circle, their footsteps crunching on the crushed flint of the path that led down to the river. Their boats would make the short journey around the river's bends and curves before disembarking, passing through a bank and ditch, and entering the long pathway that would take them to the meeting place of the dead. The sun would cast its last dying rays on the collection of enormous standing stones where the ancestral spirits dwelt, perfectly aligned with the pathway on which they approached. Here and now, as the sun set on the winter solstice, the veil between the living and the dead would grow thin enough for the new honored dead to pass through, joining their predecessors on the other side. Stonehenge is one of the most striking and enigmatic monuments of this long-past Neolithic world. But now, thanks to decades of cutting-edge research, we can enter the lives, practices, and even, to some limited and fleeting degree, the minds of the people who built this incredible place more than 4,000 years ago. Also, I wrote a book. It's called The Verge: Reformation, Renaissance, and 40 Years That Shook the World. If you enjoyed our seasons of Tides on the early modern period, then you'll like this, I promise. The Verge is available now, and you can order a hard copy, ebook, or audiobook, which I read, of course, from your distributor of choice. If you've been looking for a way to support Tides of History, ordering The Verge is the best way you could do it, and I'd really appreciate it. There's a link in this episode description that will take you there. Hi, everybody. From Wondery, welcome to another episode of Tides of History. I'm Patrick Wyman. Thanks for joining me. Stonehenge is an iconic place. Its enormous standing stones are mysterious, eternal, and instantly recognizable. Simply looking at them inspires questions. Who built it? When? How did they do it? But most of all, why? What drove people to expend their time and resources to construct such an incredible and lasting monument? Were they building an astronomical observatory, an outdoor temple, a cemetery, or something else entirely? People have been digging at Stonehenge since the 17th century, but over the past 100 years, and especially the last 2 decades, researchers have gained stunning insights into Stonehenge. Not only the monument itself, which has been extensively explored, but also the people who built it, and the beliefs and practices that gave Stonehenge meaning for them. These investigations have gone a long way toward helping us answer who the builders were, when they did it, how they did so, and even that most elusive of questions, why. But as strange as it might sound, those questions only scratch the surface of what makes Stonehenge such a fascinating place. 2 other things demand a deeper kind of attention. Instead, Stonehenge was very much a work in progress. It was built, changed, used, and reused by generation after generation of people. The time of active use spanned a couple of thousand years and no fewer than 5 active stages of building. Even more intriguing, the use and building spanned the most disruptive and fundamental period of change in the history of Britain, the end of the Neolithic and the beginning of the Bronze Age. The descendants of the people who built Stonehenge mostly died out or were driven out by newcomers, but Stonehenge remained a central place for Britain's new Bronze Age inhabitants. Second, and more important, Stonehenge wasn't off on its own, just sitting there as a lonesome series of standing stones away from people and activities. Instead, it was just one part of a much larger landscape that stretched for miles and miles in every direction. Ditches, banks, other standing stones, and burials all surrounded Stonehenge itself, but that was only the beginning. There were circles built of timber, earthen mounds, processional ways, enclosures, feasting sites, and much more, all in close proximity to the monument we know. If we want to understand Stonehenge, then we need to come to terms with what else was around it, its relationship to the other monuments, settlements, and varied sites of activity nearby. As with Stonehenge itself, this broader landscape wasn't static. It too changed over time. This, in turn, shifted how people used and understood Stonehenge itself. So, in today's episode, we're going to answer those basic questions about Stonehenge and its construction that we started with. Who built it and why? But it's only by dealing with these other aspects, its use over time, and especially its position in the landscape, that we can really make sense of it. If we ask, how did people use and understand Stonehenge, then the answer is always going to depend on which people we're talking about, when, and from what points of reference around it. One note at the very beginning here, the book I'm relying on most heavily is Mike Parker Pearson's Stonehenge, A New Understanding, which came out about a decade ago. Its basic conclusions haven't changed since then, but there has been a huge amount of new work published as articles in the meantime in specialty journals, especially one called Antiquity. Let's start with the groundwork. What is Stonehenge and how do we define it? So, in the most basic sense, Stonehenge is a monument made up of a series of stone circles set within an earthwork. It has an outer arrangement of standing stones called sarsens, with horizontal lintel stones set on top of the vertical stones, connecting them in a continuous circle. The vertical stones stand about 13 feet, about 4 meters high, and weigh 25 tons. Inside that outer circle of sarsens is a ring of smaller blue stones. They're standing stones of a different type. Inside the blue stones is yet another formation of standing stones, a horseshoe-shaped grouping of even larger sarsens. These are trilithons, two vertical stones with a horizontal lintel stone above them. But these are freestanding, they're not connected to one another like that outer circle. The earthwork surrounding the whole series of stone circles consists of a raised bank with a ditch outside it. Ironically, this means that Stonehenge, which gave the name to this whole widespread class of monuments, isn't technically a true henge in the sense that archaeologists use the term. A true henge has the ditch inside the bank. At Stonehenge, the ditch is outside the bank. Those are just the main components of the monument, the most visible pieces. Stonehenge has an entrance with a single large sarsen standing stone, known as the heel stone, which is aligned with sunrise and sunset on the solstices. There are also several earthen barrows inside the enclosure with large stones on top. There's a ring of 56 holes running just inside the earthen bank. These are called Aubrey holes. There are a whole bunch of other now empty holes and pits dating to various periods, and there are a ton of burials. All of those various features date to different periods of construction. The stones have been moved around repeatedly since they were first brought to the location. The blue stones in particular are in a different alignment now than they were originally. Some of the materials used in the construction are relatively local. The sarsens are a type of sandstone found within about 20 miles, 32 kilometers. But the blue stones originally came from a quarry in Wales, 140 miles away, 225 kilometers. We have a pretty good sense for when these various phases of building and rearranging happened. The most recent round of investigations in and around Stonehenge, called the Stonehenge Riverside Project and run by that archaeologist named Mike Parker Pearson that I mentioned earlier, this ran from 2003 to 2009, and it placed a ton of emphasis on dating, on when these things happened. We've talked before about radiocarbon dating, its possibilities, and its limitations. What's become clear in the last couple of decades is that the more dates you get from a site as a whole or from an individual feature on that site, the more accurate your dating will be. That's because radiocarbon dates are probabilistic and they're not absolute. They express a range. So the greater number of samples you have, the tighter the range gets. This is how the investigators approach Stonehenge, by trying to get as many dates as possible, and the result is a reasonably solid timeline. People had been coming to this spot on the chalklands near the River Avon for a long time before anything was built on the site of Stonehenge. During the 8th millennium BC, Mesolithic hunter-gatherers built a line of three pine post holes about 200 meters, just over 650 feet, northwest of Stonehenge. We don't know what these posts were for. Maybe something like totem poles, maybe markers pointing toward the nearby hill, but they're unusual for the period, and they were not part of a building. Activity around what became Stonehenge picked up in the Neolithic after around 4000 BC, as farmers brought their way of life to Britain from the continent and spread out. They cleared the forests for their fields and pastures and built farmsteads and villages. In the vicinity of Stonehenge, the earliest evidence for the farmers' presence is a large pit at Coneybury, about 1.4 kilometers, just over 3/4 of a mile, southeast, between the site and the River Avon. The pit is full of the remains of a feast, the bones of at least 10 cattle, several roe and red deer, and a pig, along with a bunch of broken early Neolithic pottery. There are also stone tools in the pit, and intriguingly, they're of both Neolithic and Mesolithic type. The best explanation for the pit is some kind of cross-cultural feasting event, a meeting between the Mesolithic hunter-gatherers who had been in Britain for millennia and the newly arrived farmers. The farmers brought the cattle, the foragers brought the deer, and everybody presumably had a good time. This feast took place sometime between 3900 and 3700 BC. In the centuries after the feast at Coneybury, the landscape filled up with monuments and constructions. Long barrows holding the remains of the dead, a pair of cursus monuments, linear banks and ditches enclosing long, straight, thin sections of land that were connected to the barrows, and a couple of settlements. The first stage of construction at Stonehenge itself dates to somewhere between 3015 and 2935 BC. There were no stones at this point, just the circular ditch with an interior bank around 100 meters or 330 feet in diameter. It had two entrances, a small one in the south and a main access point in the northeast that had a wooden facade built over it. Three stone holes sat in a line outside the entrance and presumably held standing stones. But the earthworks and entrance weren't the only thing. From the beginning, Stonehenge was designed and built as a stone circle. It's just not the one that we see today. A ring of 56 pits, known as Aubrey Holes, after the 17th century antiquarian who hypothesized their existence, runs around the very inside lip of the bank. They're nowhere near the size we'd expect for the large sarsen stones that make up most of Stonehenge today, and they're not deep enough to hold wooden posts of the kind we see at a timber circle. At the bottom of some of these holes, archaeologists excavating almost a century ago found burnt human bones, the remains of cremation burials that date to this first phase of construction. But what about above the bones? Archaeologists have argued extensively about this, but the current consensus is that the Aubrey holes originally held small upright stones, probably blue stones. The remains of wooden post holes in the center of the stone circle also date to this first stage, maybe even before the standing stones were there. The purpose of the post holes is unclear, but they may have been an excarnation platform where recently deceased corpses were picked clean of flesh by birds. Roughly 500 years after this first stage of construction, between 2620 and 2480 BC, the second stage of construction began at Stonehenge. This was when the monument mostly took on the form it retains today. The circle of bluestones and the Aubrey holes around the inner side of the bank was dismantled. The horseshoe of trilithons, the arrangement of huge standing stones at the center of the monument, went in first. Next, the bluestones were arranged in a ring around them. And finally, the outer ring of sarsens, the uprights with their continuous ring of lintel stones on top, completed the core. Two earthworks, the north barrow and south barrow, also date to this period. So do the three upright stones that formed a facade across the main entrance in the northeast of the earthwork. With the completion of stage two, the major work at Stonehenge was mostly done, but various acts of construction and rebuilding continued for another 1,000 years afterward.
Do you ever wonder where all your money went? Like every single time you look at your bank account? Honestly, it's probably all those subscriptions. I felt that way too, until I got Rocket Money. Rocket Money helped me see all the subscriptions I'm paying for, and it was eye-opening. Between streaming services, fitness apps, delivery services, it all adds up so quickly. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has helped save its members an average of $720 a year, with over 500 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/Wondery. That's rocketmoney.com/Wondery. rocketmoney.com/Wondery.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code AUDIO to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code AUDIO at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code AUDIO.
Archaeologists have identified three subsequent stages of construction and modification at Stonehenge after the monument mostly took on the form we know today. Stage 3, from 2480 to 2280 BC, saw the construction of what's called the Stonehenge Avenue, a parallel pair of ditches and banks leading from the entrance to the River Avon. The Stonehenge Avenue runs for 2 miles, about 3 kilometers, and it actually leads to another stone circle called Blue Stonehenge. During Stage 3, Blue Stonehenge was dismantled, its massive stones were uprooted. It's likely that they were transplanted to Stonehenge itself during this phase, perhaps placed in an arc just outside one of the massive trilithons at the center of the circle. This was a time of massive change within Britain. One of the signs of that transition was a burial in the ditch outside Stonehenge, a man who had been shot at least 3 times with arrows. Appropriately, he's known as the Stonehenge Archer. Stage 4, from 2270 to 2020 BC, immediately followed. During this period, the blue stones were rearranged into the two formations, the circle and the oval, where they now reside. More pits were dug in Stage 5, around 500 years after this last bit of major construction work, but their purpose is unclear and they may never have been used for anything. People kept coming to Stonehenge after this, we know because of finds of Iron Age and Roman pottery, but after about 1500 BC, they stopped building on the site. So that's the basic outline of Stonehenge's construction. Two major stages, one around 3000 BC and the other around 2500 BC, with sporadic work for another millennium after that. For about 1500 years, then, people were actively building at Stonehenge. They used picks made from deer antlers to dig ditches and holes, they piled up earth into banks, and they moved massive stones into a variety of positions. They created processional ways and avenues in the surrounding landscape, routes that led to and from Stonehenge and the other monuments in its neighborhood. For a long time, at least 500 years, some specific group of people was buried at Stonehenge. All told, we're talking about millions of man-hours of labor undertaken by thousands of people across dozens of generations to build, maintain, and modify all of this. The amount of work involved is mind-boggling, requiring technical skills in stone carving and transport, construction, and of course the logistics to feed all of these people. That's leaving aside the necessary motivation to get them to do so. Why? What was all this for? To answer that question, we need to take a step back from Stonehenge itself and do what I talked about at the beginning. To look at Stonehenge not in isolation, not just the standing stones, not just the earthworks and so on, but as part of a broader landscape. Landscapes are a big deal in archaeology. They have been for a few decades now. It's been a long time since archaeologists devoted all of their time and energy to analyzing isolated sites or even just features within those sites. Not that they ever completely did. That's because you simply can't understand a site on its own. It is impossible. It literally does not make sense to intentionally put on blinders and restrict your view of what else is around the thing you're working on. So, one of the most fundamental questions any archaeologist asks when looking at a site is what its relationship to other things might be. Those other things include other archaeological sites, obviously, but also natural features like hills and waterways. Simply walking and systematically surveying the ground around the site is absolutely necessary. That kind of work's been standard for a long time now. You'd be surprised at what kinds of lumps, bumps, and features you can find just by taking a stroll with a knowledgeable eye. But our tools for understanding past landscapes have gotten much better over the past few decades, too. Geographic information systems, GIS for short, allow us to plot and analyze all kinds of data on a digital map of physical space at every scale from the hyperlocal to the continental. Geophysical surveys with magnetometry and ground-penetrating radar give us insight into what's under the ground, helping archaeologists better target their excavations and sometimes telling us what might be there without having to dig at all. This isn't easy or foolproof, but it is possible to cover enormous amounts of ground with these tools, much more than we could ever hope to excavate. LIDAR, 3D laser scanning, is the most promising of all. It bounces lasers off the Earth to create incredibly detailed models of the surface, even stripping away thick tree cover to do so. The end result of all that is a dramatically enhanced ability to place a monument built thousands of years ago into its proper context, the landscape in which its builders and users would have seen and understood it. And Stonehenge's landscape is one of the most deeply investigated and best understood in the entire world. In fact, for more than 40 years, Stonehenge has been something of a proving ground for the study of archaeological landscapes as a whole. All of those tools I've mentioned have been combined with enormous excavation and analysis projects, giving us absolutely unparalleled insight into Stonehenge and its surroundings between 4,000 and 5,000 years ago. The landscape around Stonehenge was absolutely full of other stuff. An extensive field survey in 1982 estimated that there are a total of 51 million pieces of worked flint dotting the fields around the monument. This testifies to the incredible amounts of activity throughout the Neolithic and the Bronze Age. I mentioned that pit at Coeneybury that held the remains of a cross-cultural feast around 4000 BC, soon after the Neolithic farmers' arrival in Britain. They stayed busy in the subsequent centuries. They built a series of monuments throughout the immediate vicinity. The most outstanding of these was a pair of what are known as the Cursus monuments, the Greater Cursus and the Lesser Cursus, which were built sometime around 3500 BC. Cursus monuments have been found throughout Britain. They all follow the same general form, with a pair of ditches and banks enclosing a long, thin, sometimes extremely long, strip of land. The Greater Cursus is a genuinely enormous example of this type. It's 3 kilometers, about 2 miles long from end to end, and about 100 meters, 330 feet wide. A long barrow, an earthen mound built over a stone burial chamber, sits at the eastern end of the Greater Cursus and was built at approximately the same time. The Lesser Cursus is much shorter. It's about 400 meters or 1,300 feet long. It too points toward a smaller barrow, this one at the western end. Cursus monuments, like henges, are only found in Britain. They're hard to understand anywhere, and the two in the vicinity of Stonehenge are no exception. The most widely followed interpretation sees them as something like processional ways leading from the land of the living to the land of the dead, represented by the barrow tombs found at their ends. Like the barrows, they required huge amounts of labor. The ditches were dug out in stages, probably by a few tens of laborers working together at a time for months or years. But there are many barrow tombs around Stonehenge. There are about 15 of them, all dating to the same Middle Neolithic period. So why were these the ones that had a Cursus monument attached? Were they particularly important ancestors who had to be honored? Should we see them as evidence of social hierarchies, that some people could compel others to work on their or their ancestors' behalf? For now, we don't know. The key point is that these two monuments, with their associated barrows, were already there and close when construction began at Stonehenge. The Greater Cursus is only half a mile, about 3/4 of a kilometer, to the north of the monument. It sits on a chalk high point leading down into Stonehenge Bottom, a dry valley that runs past Stonehenge's eastern side. Another earthwork monument of a type called a causewayed enclosure sits about 3 miles, 4 kilometers away. It probably predates both of the Cursus monuments. So this area along the River Avon had already borne the visible marks of a human presence for a very long time before any work was done on the eventual site of Stonehenge. But around 3000 BC, the builders did in fact come to Stonehenge, where they constructed its first phase. This was just the ditch and bank that form its outer edge today, along with the 56 aubrey holes running along the perimeter, and whatever the wooden post holes in the middle once held. a building maybe, or more likely platforms on which the recently deceased were exposed to remove the flesh. What recent research has emphasized about this first phase, however, is that Stonehenge originally functioned as a cemetery. In fact, it is the largest cemetery of its era that has been found in Britain. For 5 centuries after the initial construction, people came to the site to bury their dead. Intriguingly, a bunch of burials have been excavated in and around the Aubrey Holes, which once held small standing stones called bluestones. The burials were at the very bottom of the pits, with the stones erected on top. The interpretation is that individual ancestors were associated with individual stones, to which descendant kin groups returned over time so they could pay their respects to the honored dead. So, the most recent analyses of Stonehenge's earliest phase emphasize that it was a cemetery, and most likely a cemetery associated with specific ancestors. Around 2500 BC, however, 2620 to 2480, based on the radiocarbon dating, something changed. This was when the second major phase of building began at Stonehenge, the point at which the massive stone circles were arranged in the form they mostly retain up to the present. What changed then? And why build Stonehenge in that form in stone? The answer to those questions, or at least significant clues, lies about 2 miles, 3 kilometers, northeast of Stonehenge, at a place called Durrington. Archaeologists have known about the Henge, a place called Durrington Walls, for centuries. The earth bank, with the ditch inside the bank, which makes it a proper henge, unlike Stonehenge, is still visible. It's still big now, and it would have been truly enormous when it was first built. The ditch was more than 5 meters, 20 feet deep, and 18 meters, about 60 feet wide. In some places, the bank was 30 meters, 100 feet wide. But as striking as the henge would have been, and it's still huge today, even after 4,000 years of plowing and erosion, what it was built around and on top of is more impressive still. Durrington Walls was once a settlement covering more than 42 acres, filled with square houses, littered with Neolithic trash from feasts and gatherings that involved thousands of people from all over Britain. 2 huge timber circles, like Stonehenge but built of wood instead, dominated its central area. A wide avenue, paved with flint, led from the southern of the timber circles down to the River Avon. Another timber circle, surrounded by a henge of its own, would be built a few centuries later, only 70 meters, 230 feet, away from the southern of the Durrington Walls circles. Woodhenge, as this monument is known, may have been built as the same time as the henge enclosure around and over Durrington Walls. Even more recent research, published in 2020 and 2021, led by the archaeologist Vincent Gaffney, has argued for an even larger monumental landscape surrounding Durrington Walls. Archaeologists found an arrangement of enormous pits laid out in a rough circle around the henge, a circle with a diameter of about 2 kilometers, 1.2 miles. It's probable that these pits, which are really, really big, once contained timber posts, shafts, or wells dug down into the ground for ritual purposes, and potentially other things as well. We just don't know quite yet. I mentioned the paved avenue a moment ago that led from the southern timber circle at Durrington Walls down to the River Avon. It's a short journey, as the River Avon runs close to Durrington Walls. Then the river curves and meanders its way through the landscape before it comes closer to Stonehenge. There, another stone circle sat quite near the river. This was as many as 27 distinctive bluestones arranged in a circle 10 meters or 33 feet across. It's not certain when Bluestonehenge, as it's called, was first erected. The radiocarbon dates are frustratingly imprecise, but sometime during Stonehenge's initial use as a cemetery is a good guess, between 3000 and 2600 BC. After that, at the same time as Stonehenge was rebuilt into its massive current form and Durrington Walls exploded into a huge settlement with its timber circles, this bluestone circle down by the river was dismantled. Its stones were almost certainly taken to Stonehenge to become part of the monument itself, and the circle was replaced by an earthwork henge, a bank with a ditch on the inside. This is an important spot because it's the obvious landing point for someone coming south along the River Avon from Durrington Walls to Stonehenge. The new henge at the former Bluestone Circle became the start of yet another monumental construction, a long path stretching 3 kilometers or 2 miles from the river to Stonehenge itself. This was the Stonehenge Avenue, with raised earthen banks around the edges to accentuate it in the landscape. Like Stonehenge itself, the route was partially aligned with the sunrise on the summer solstice and the sunset on the winter solstice. Intriguingly, that same part of the path was also aligned with a natural feature in the ground, paraglacial ridges that were visible as raised lines in the ground. When Neolithic people saw these natural ridges, pointing directly toward the midwinter sunset and the midsummer sunrise, it must have influenced their desire to build on this spot in the first place. So what should we make of all this? How were Durrington walls, its timber circles, and the avenue leading from Bluestonehenge to Stonehenge all connected? Why did thousands of people spend centuries building and adding on to this monumental landscape? Who were they and where did they come from? Most of all, what did it mean to them?
If you travel for work, you know to pack two suits, business and swim. You know with your Delta SkyMiles Business Amex card, buying that plane ticket for a business trip can get you closer to medallion status. You know that a meeting in Montana means visiting almost every national park.
Yellowstone? Check.
Because you're the chief excursion officer. It's why you're a Delta SkyMiles Platinum Business American Express card member. If you travel, you know. Terms apply. Visit go.amex/youknowbusiness.
These associated monuments and features, but especially what archaeologists have uncovered at Durrington Walls, are absolutely essential to understanding Stonehenge. They're intimately connected to one another in a number of ways, ranging from the practical to the metaphysical. In a practical sense, Durrington Walls has to have been where Stonehenge's builders lived, at least for that second crucial phase when the massive sarsens were erected and later when the avenue was built. These were mind-bogglingly enormous projects in terms of the amount of time and labor required. Millions of hours of labor involving thousands of laborers carried out over months or more likely years of activity. All those people needed somewhere to live while they were working, and they must have left some sort of trace in the landscape. Durrington Walls is the only settlement archaeologists have found anywhere close to Stonehenge that could have accommodated the necessary number of people. But the settlement at Durrington Walls wasn't just a builder's settlement, a place for them to live while they built the more important monument a little way down the River Avon. It had its own ceremonial avenue, elaborately paved with stone. It had its own circles, built not in stone but in timber. Two of them placed right in the middle of the small rectangular houses where the builders slept. There had to be something more happening at Durrington Walls. So let's return to Stonehenge for just a moment. As the name implies, it was built of stone. This is so intrinsic to the monument that we take it for granted. It's easy to forget about the earth bank and ditch, the ceremonial avenue leading down to the river, and all the other assorted lumps and bumps and features surrounding the stone. But even if we keep all of that other stuff in mind, the mere fact of the stone often gets lost. Why build Stonehenge in stone, in this particular layout, using these specific techniques? All of that stuff requires an explanation. Timber circles were a common phenomenon in the world of Stonehenge's builders. After all, they constructed several of them at Durrington Walls at exactly the same time they were working on Stonehenge. But because wood rots so easily, they almost never survive. One of the few exceptions is called Seahenge, a timber circle on England's Norfolk coast that dates, quite precisely, to the year 2049 BC. In most cases, we're only left with the post holes in which the upright timbers once sat. That's if we're lucky. Plowing can easily destroy the faint stains in the soil that mark post holes, and so can subsequent construction. If a stone circle was later built on the site of a former timber circle, the stone holes can easily obliterate the evidence of that previous structure. But because timber circles seem to have been so common, and timber is so much easier to work than stone, why would you choose to build in stone at all? The word choose is key there. It was a choice, a conscious decision that must have said something about how these Neolithic people understood the world. The most convincing explanation for this comes from the archaeologist Mike Parker Pearson, who has led excavations around Stonehenge for many years, and the Malagasy archaeologist Remily Sunina. The two of them first suggested this back in the 90s, and to the extent that it is a testable hypothesis, subsequent excavations and analysis have mostly supported their argument. For Parker Pearson and Remily Sunina, wood and stone represent opposites. impermanence and permanence in a general sense, and more specifically, wood for the living and stone for the dead. Durrington Walls, with its timber circles and lively gatherings of thousands of people, was the place of the living. Stonehenge, with its burials and standing stones, was the place of the dead. The avenues linking Durrington Walls to the Avon and the Avon to Stonehenge, with a brief trip down the river in between, was a reflection of the journey from life to death. As the sun rose on the summer solstice and set on the winter solstice, that journey would have taken on special significance. The astronomical alignment of Stonehenge mattered, otherwise they wouldn't have built it the way that they did, but the monument wasn't some kind of ancient observatory. Stonehenge's meaning was predicated on prior knowledge of that alignment, not an attempt to measure it or anything else. The timber circles at Durrington Walls and the stone circles at Stonehenge were mirrors of one another. In fact, the archaeologist Josh Pollard has said that Stonehenge is actually our most outstanding example of a timber circle. This sounds counterintuitive, but the logic is sound. Rather than being modeled on the ancient stone monuments of the earlier Neolithic, like the stone chambers inside long barrows or portal tombs, all of which had gone out of fashion many centuries before, Stonehenge was simply a timber circle built in stone. The stonemasons applied the techniques of carpentry and woodworking to stone. They used mortise and tenon joints, tongue and groove jointing on the lintels, and they dressed the stone in ways that exactly copied the techniques applied more commonly to wood. The southern timber circle at Durrington Walls has a horseshoe-shaped setting of posts at the center, just like Stonehenge with its horseshoe arrangement of trilithons in the middle. That horseshoe arrangement is a reflection of a new architectural form that was coming into use in the Neolithic at precisely the time when Stonehenge's second phase was built. The D-shaped meeting house, a communal building found across Britain at the time. One was excavated at Durrington Walls right next to the southern timber circle. One for the living, one for the dead. Stonehenge's heart was a permanent meeting place for the builders' deceased ancestors, a stone version of the communal houses in which they met during their lives. The builders of Stonehenge's second phase, then, were creating a permanent monument to their honored dead. Not just the people who had been buried there over the preceding centuries or who would continue to be buried there afterward, but a more general sense of their deceased ancestors. They remade the entire landscape, using the pre-existing monuments and the natural layout of the land, to better honor those ancestors and mark that journey in physical space. But who were the living and who were their dead? Were they simply the local inhabitants of the area around Stonehenge, or did the monument's connections go further? On the basis of evidence excavated and analyzed over the past couple of decades, we can firmly say that Stonehenge wasn't just a local monument. It was a site that pulled in people, building materials, and even animals from all over Britain. From the very beginning, Stonehenge was connected to the broader world. The Sarsen stones that make up the outer circle and the massive trilithons at the center are relatively local. They come from no more than 20 miles, about 32 kilometers away, maybe even closer than that. But the site's blue stones have a far more distant origin. Recent research has pinpointed at least some of the quarries from which they originally came, a series of sites in Wales more than 100 miles or 150 kilometers away. One of them, Craig Ros y Felin, has evidence of early Neolithic activity dating from roughly 3620 to 3120 BC. Even the original blue stones at Stonehenge, those placed in the Aubrey holes during the first phase of construction around 3000 BC, were not local. They almost certainly came from another stone circle in Wales at a place called Wan Mon, which was dismantled. The stones were then brought all the way to Stonehenge, 140 miles, 230 kilometers away. Assuming these were the people who soon after buried the cremated remains of their dead under the blue stones in the Aubrey holes, maybe they were bringing their ancestors with them. These broader connections continued into Stonehenge's second phase, the one that included the erection of the massive circle of Sarsen stones, and which coincided with the timber circles at Durrington Walls. Excavations at Durrington Walls have turned up huge amounts of evidence for feasting that was seasonal in nature. Pits full of processed pig bones have been found in the spaces between the houses. Isotope studies of the bones reveal that the animals were brought from all over Britain, some of them from as far away as Wales, perhaps even Scotland. Pigs don't move on their own. People have to take them, and pigs are much harder to transport than cattle or sheep. So we have evidence for the consumption of large quantities of meat using a specific kind of animal brought from a wide range of environments across Britain at a certain time of the year, specifically winter. The best explanation for this data is that people came to Durrington Walls and presumably to Stonehenge as well from all over Britain. They came at a specific time of the year in the winter, presumably for the winter solstice. They came for feasts, bringing a specific kind of animal with them to be slaughtered and roasted at Durrington Walls. One of the roasting pits sat just outside the entrance to the southern timber circle, the Circle of the Living. People came, ate, celebrated, and then perhaps made their way along the ceremonial paths to Stonehenge. Maybe they brought their dead with them, or at least small quantities of cremated bone as a representation of the deceased. Some of the cremated bone found on the site certainly dates to this later period. They may have placed these few burnt bones in the ditch surrounding the earthen bank in the stone circle. Durrington Walls wasn't just the land of the living, with its impermanence marked by the wood of its timber circles. It was quite literally a temporary place. It was occupied mostly by the thousands who came there once or at most twice a year to feast and renew their connections with their fellow Neolithic people and their ancestors. Stonehenge was permanent and everlasting, but it was empty aside from those brief moments like the winter solstice when the living crossed over. More than that is hard for us to say. We'll never know precisely what they did or how it made them feel or precisely what they believed their relationship with these ancestral dead may have been. But the fact that we know this much about the monuments they built, the vague outlines of their belief system, and their wider world is truly extraordinary. This is a world that has been gone for more than 4,000 years, and yet we can gain these amazing insights into these people and their lives. There's a note of tragedy here. Britain's Neolithic people don't seem to have left many later descendants. Whether they were struck by plague or environmental disasters or were wiped out by the Beaker people who began to migrate to Britain in a campaign of genocide, well, that's hard to say right now. But the other remarkable thing is that these later people, like the Beaker folk, continued to come to Stonehenge, and they too saw it as a place of the dead. They buried both complete bodies and cremated remains around the monument. Despite this exceptional break in prehistory, the huge gap between the Neolithic and the Bronze Age and the people who made them, Stonehenge remained. We can guess that its meanings changed, that later people saw it differently than the ones who had built it and continued to come there, but it kept pulling at those who saw it and heard about it for millennia to come. Next time on Tides of History, we're going to head back to the Near East, where a new series of empires and kingdoms began to rise in Syria and Mesopotamia, the Assyrians and the Babylonians. Hey, Prime members, you can listen to Tides of History ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the app today. Or you can listen ad-free with Wondery Plus in Apple Podcasts. Before you go, tell us about yourself by completing a short survey at wondery.com/survey. I've also written a book called The Verge, Reformation, Renaissance, and 40 Years That Shook the World. It's available now on hard copy, ebook, or audiobook from your distributor of choice. And there's a link in this episode description that will take you there. Tides of History is written and narrated by me, Patrick Wyman. Sound design by Molly Bach for Airship. The sound engineer is Sergio Enriquez. Tides of History is produced by Morgan Jaffe. From Wondery, the executive producers are Jenny Lower Beckman and Marshall Louie. Thanks again for listening. Until next time, from Wondery, this has been Tides of History.
If you travel for work, you know to pack two suits, business and swim. You know with your Delta SkyMiles Business Amex card, buying that plane ticket for a business trip can get you closer to medallion status. You know that a meeting in Montana means visiting almost every national park.
Yellowstone? Check.
Because you're the chief excursion officer. It's why you're a Delta SkyMiles Platinum Business American Express card member. If you travel, you know. Terms apply. Visit go.amex/you-know-business.